Well, hello and welcome to another edition of Authors Audio. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Remember, you can listen to all of our interviews by visiting our website at www.authorsaudio.com. Click on the listen icon or the iTunes icon and listen to all the interviews from there. I have with me today a very interesting man and a very interesting author who has led a very, very precarious life, to say the least. I'm talking about author James Brown from L.A., and he is the author of several novels, including Lucky Town, Final Performance, and the Los Angeles Diaries. He has received the Nelson Algren Award for Short Fiction, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Fiction Writing, and a Chesterfield Film Writing Fellowship from Universal Amblin Entertainment. His writing has been featured in the Los Angeles Times Magazine, Denver Quarterly, and the New England Review. He lives now with his family in Lake Arrowhead, California. Now, James Brown, at 5 years old, if you can picture this, waits in a car while his mother sets fire to a building, setting off a chain of events that permanently unravels and damages his comfortable, stable family home life. Brown watches all the certainties of childhood disappear at this young age with her subsequent imprisonment. Thereafter, tragedy follows him like a brush fire spread on the Santa Ana winds. As he emulates his sister and brother, Brown escapes into heavy alcohol and drug use. Brown gently and elliptically describes his brilliant brother, a man of rare intelligence and a promising acting career, who ended up shooting himself at the age of 27. Brown's sensitive, shy sister hangs on till her 40s when finally, after a lifetime of disappointment and cocaine-fueled benders, finally leaps off a highway overpass onto the concrete below. The only sober and sure thing in his life that keeps Brown going is his writing. Between his own days and weeks of drinking and drugging, he writes with the knowledge that every idea, every script meeting, every chance at a screenplay, bought or sold, might be his last. And I'd like to really warmly welcome to the program James Brown. And James, it's a great pleasure to have you with us today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be on it.
Well, it's certainly great to have you on, Jim, and I've been looking forward to speaking with you. You know, your book L.A. Diaries is certainly a book for so many people out there who have run into trouble in their lives and have turned to, whether it's alcohol or drugs or destructive behavior in general. And really, this is their story too. It's a story of people who, through no fault of their own, mainly and usually, have run into some various serious walls. And it's taken a lot to write this, I would think, out of you. But I was wondering why it took so long after your experiences to finally sit down and put this book together.
Well, frankly, I had to reach a certain bottom. You'll hear that term used frequently with people who wrestle with issues of addiction, whether it's with alcohol or drugs. And I needed to get some clean and sober time, which is something that I hadn't had for the majority of my life. And so there was a period of approximately 9 years where I was between books. My last novel came out, I'd have forgotten the year now, but it was called Lucky Town. It was with Harcourt Brace. And then there was a spell there about 9 years where I didn't publish a book. It's not to say I wasn't writing. I was doing some screen work in Hollywood, but it was sporadic. And for the most part, I had done so much damage to myself physically, psychologically, mentally, that the process of writing became just a huge obstacle. I was afraid to write. I couldn't write. I became hypercritical. My life was also in turmoil. So it wasn't until I got a little clarity, a little time, that I was able to begin looking at my own life, and I felt that the next book I needed to write was the Los Angeles Diaries, to try and help make sense out of many of the things that had happened to me, you know, prior to the writing or the telling of that story.
Before we get started into the book itself, which is an extremely interesting read, there's a technique that you use, Jim, in this book that I found very interesting, and that is that the chapters are, first of all, are non-linear in terms of time. The story gets told through the book, but it's not a linear starting from the age of 5 till whenever. And it sort of reminds me of an artist who uses different light and colors to bring forward or push back elements in a painting. And I find that this really works in L.A. Diaries, and it kind of shakes you up. You have to sort of figure out, now where are we now? We're over here. And in a strange way, it suits this book because at the same time you were living this book, you were also being shaken up many times too. So I thought that was a very interesting technique, and that's one of the things I wanted to bring out in the book.
It's my contention that memory is not sequential. And when I was putting this book together, I didn't want to write a typical autobiography, you know, beginning with I was born in 1957 in San Jose, California. My mother's maiden name was Agrillo, and just begin with those kind of fundamentals. What I came to believe is that there are, and what I still believe, is that there are certain episodes, there are certain events in life that happen to us that are defining moments, the moments that shape who we are as a character and as a person. They're the moments that we don't forget, the events that we don't forget that linger, that continue to haunt us. And what my intention was not to write a straight chronological, you know, memoir beginning with the beginning and ending, you know, in my middle age, but rather to try and capture the most defining moments of my life. And I didn't want to put them necessarily in chronological order, although I feel that when you get to the end of the book, you have passed through my childhood, you have passed through adolescence, you have passed through my early adulthood and into my middle age, but not in that order.
Now, the book starts off with you as 5 years, being 5 years old, and you're in the car waiting for your mother as she sets fire to, it's a building, but it's your home, is it?
It's an apartment building that was actually, as I found out later, which is not in the book, but was occupied by her father and her sister and another one of her relatives. So she burnt down the apartment in which her family lived and had the insurance on that building forged and put into her name. She was attempting to collect on a falsified insurance policy on the apartment building in which her family lived. That's stuff that I found out after the fact. A part of that isn't in the book.
Now, your mother had many good points about her character and personality and the things that she did for you and with you, but she also had I guess you would have to call it a destructive part of her personality that was very, very difficult for the family. Were you closer to your father then than your mother, or how did that work out?
I was closer to my father, even though not sure who, you know, if I were to try and divide the years, how much time I spent with my father as opposed to my mother, because I came from a broken family. So part of my childhood was spent with my mother in the very, very earliest years. And then my adolescence was spent in large part with my father, but I moved out of the house at 17. And so I didn't have a lot of years with him either, but I did return frequently to work with my father. He was a building contractor, and he taught me a lot about the trade, so I had the opportunity to learn from him mostly through work. I came to love him by working with him. He taught me a different way of life than the criminal kind of life that I had lived before I had come to live with my father. My mother did her best given the tools that God gave her, but she suffered and was from mental illness. And it was at one time diagnosed as schizophrenic by the court psychologist, where she had the opportunity to either be institutionalized in a mental institution or to do straight time. Had she chosen to go to the mental institution, she would have been able to return home to her family on the weekends. But she didn't want the stigma of mental illness associated with herself, and so she chose to do her straight time.
Well, I just want to take a moment to remind our listeners that we're talking to the author of L.A. Diaries, and his name, of course, is James Brown. There's one part in the book where Jim imagines that he's dancing with his father, and they're just having a good old hoot at home. And yet Jim told me that, no, he didn't actually do that. He really was too shy to really do that. But it gives you an idea of the closeness that he wanted, as any young kid would. He misses his mother. His mother had to leave the family unit and go to the hospital. And he's trying to make this connection, like every kid likes to make with their parents. And it's just a very beautiful part of the book. And yet, on the other side, the addictive, destructive personality also comes out. So it's not a fairy tale book, but it is a very genuine documentary, I think, of how James felt on the inside and transmitted this out into the world through his book, L.A. Diaries.
It was a poignant moment in my life. It's something I wished I had done and did not do. My father, while my mother was incarcerated, my father, of course, missed her. And our lives had fallen apart. We had suffered bankruptcy. Everything had changed. He was a drinker, and I guess by today's standard, he would be considered alcoholic. But by the standard and the generation in which he grew up, it was quite common that to drink on a daily basis, so long as you were able to function the following day and get your work done. So he drank in the evening after work. And when he would drink, sometimes he would get sentimental. And he loved Patsy Cline, and he used to have this old reel-to-reel tape recorder, and he'd put on that Patsy Cline song, and he'd get sentimental and he'd want to dance. And I was too young, and I was just a kid, and I was kind of embarrassed by him, and I didn't want to dance with him. But now, you know, as I look back, he'd want to dance on the kitchen floor, you know, listening to Patsy Cline, and I never danced with him. But now looking back, I can understand his pain, and I can understand his loneliness in a way that I couldn't as a child. And that particular piece you're referring to, My Papa's Waltz, the title was taken from a Theodore Rethke poem. That's something I wished I had done. But this is one of the virtues of the memoirs, that you have the ability to reflect, see yourself in a different light. So from the child's perspective, you see me, and then at the end of that piece, you see the adult coming forth and saying, in my mind, in my writing, in my dreams today, I get up from that kitchen table and I embrace my father. That's the intended point. That is the intended poignancy of it.
Now, as you became older and became more less of a child and more of a man or an adult in adult situations, obviously you had this artistic bent within you. You wanted to be somebody. You really wanted to be somebody that counted, and you had some inner knowledge of yourself that said that, writing and stories and this kind of thing was your bailiwick, if you will. That's your domain. And I think this is what sustained you and still sustains you. But you were a screenwriter, and you did submit your work to various companies along the way, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, I worked on and off in Hollywood. Three or four of my books have been optioned for film, and I've adapted 3 or 4 of my own books, and I've also done some work for NBC and Stephen Cannell and Warner Brothers.
Yeah, there's actually a wonderful chapter on the whole business of waiting in the office for the producer to come out and waiting and waiting and waiting. And of course, you know, these producers, they can take hours to get through. And like, who are you anyway? And of course, you're saying, I'm going to stay. Near the end of the chapter, of course, the windows are being shot out by some crazy across the street and people running around. And that sort of ended the idea of an interview for that day. As the book goes along, we find that you and not only yourself, but you and your brother and sister are growing older, and these different, you're all dealing, I think, with this broken family life in the past, and each one of you is dealing with it in different ways. As it turns out, there's only so much I should say in the book because I don't want to spoil it for the readers. But suffice to say that each one of you had a very difficult time dealing with that.
Yes, we did. I think all of us, I think it's safe to say, became alcoholic. Alcoholism is a genetic illness. A genetic illness usually compounded with the psychological and physical aspects.
You feel like addiction is a hereditary illness, I think you say somewhere.
It is definitely a hereditary illness. We can see it passed down from one generation to another, just as mental illness is passed down from one generation to another. That doesn't necessarily mean that the child of an alcoholic is doomed to alcoholism. It simply means that his or her chances of becoming alcoholic are 4 to 5 times greater than that of if the child came from a family of teetotalers. So we were kind of programmed from the very beginning to be alcoholic. We're severely alcoholic and severely depressed. I also think that, given what I know now, what is called bipolarism, but was formerly called manic depression, I prefer the term manic depression because it more aptly describes the symptoms. I think we all suffered from that as well. Today we have medications that can treat that, but...
Well, this book details a life of loss, great loss, and I'm thinking of your brother who was 26 when he killed himself. He was a promising actor in Hollywood. He had a lot going for him. He was very smart, I understand. And this must have had a huge effect on you as you were trying to be a writer and a screenplay writer.
My brother had an IQ of 170, which is, 30 points above genius level, typical genius level. That mind of his was working at a manic pace. And then he would crash and fall into a deep depression. And the drug of choice for manic depressives is alcohol. And I think all of us suffered from that same mental illness that we may or may not have inherited from our mother. And so alcohol was the logical medicine. And but then alcohol becomes its own problem. And, regardless of the causes, root causes, psychological or physiological, you now have the problem of addiction to alcohol. And my brother eventually took his life, ended it at the brief age of 27. And my sister, who also suffered from alcoholism, and she had one time collected 5 years sobriety, some of the best years of her life. And she too succumbed to suicide when she returned to drinking again. That brain is just moving too fast, and she couldn't live with herself drinking, and she couldn't live without a drink. And it's only through the grace of God and through my developing religious beliefs and my membership in the organization of AA that I've been able to maintain my sobriety and some semblance of sanity.
Well, there's one thing I'd like to comment about the way you tell this story, which is your own personal story here. It includes your mother, your father, your brother and sister, and things going on around that. But this is a family who, right from the age of a very young boy of 5 years old, it starts off by, you know, your mother burning down a building to collect fire insurance. And, you know, of course, a young boy at 5 years old, what does he know? But throughout the whole book, you remain as an observer, almost like a reporter, in the background and letting us in on this, really what it feels like. It's like told like a little movie. I find that to be very, very effective because you allow the reader to get emotionally involved in what's going on between the pages. And you yourself take a background seat to the whole thing. That's really made the book work really well, I think. And that's, I just wanted to say that and maybe have you comment on that.
And that was my intention. It's a good observation you make. I wanted to, as much to my ability, to avoid having this book sound self-pitying. You'll find a lot of memoirs that deal with addiction are stories of woe. I thought that if I just told the story and let it unfold as clearly as I could reimagine it, that the details themselves, you know, they would tell the story itself. The details would suffice. I didn't need to add a lot of commentary. And when I got to particularly dramatic moments in the story, my instinct was to undercut them because I worried about melodrama. And there's a fine line between being dramatic and being melodramatic. And so much of my story deals with such high drama that if I were to approach it differently, it could have fallen into melodrama, and that was a worry of mine.
Well, I am going to ask Jim definitely before the end of the program if he would like to read from certain portions of the book to give my listeners a little bit of an idea of the tonality of the book and how Jim tells the story. I know that in page 56 and 57, starting with a few years back, you describe your writing technique, and I found that to be very interesting. And as you go along, there's so many ups and downs here. It's not all down. And, you know, the family adopted a pig called Daisy the Pig, and Jim was very gracious to this pig. He built a wonderful little house for the pig and all the rest of it, and they had a lot of fun with that. I'm interested, Jim, on why you put that in the story. I think it's a wonderful thing to put in the story because it just seems to enliven the whole thing up and make it real and share some of the joyful or the crazy little moments that a lot of families have with their children as they're growing up.
Well, you know, that story is, all the stories are literally true. I didn't know what I had with that story the first time I wrote it. I was just writing this story about the battle that I had with this pig that I'd bought my wife because it began to take over the house and began to disturb, you know, my peace. I couldn't sleep at night because it constantly wanted to be fed. I gave a rough draft of that story to my friend, Orlando Ramirez, who's been all through the years one of my key readers. If I can get past Orlando, then I know I think I've got something good, because he's pretty critical with me. And he says, well, yeah, you told the story of the pig, but don't you see the connection here between the pig and yourself? And I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, the addiction, alcoholism, you're desire to drink is just as compelling as the pig's desire to eat. And once he made that observation, then I was able to go back and rethink that story and tell a parallel story. And so it's not simply a story about the burgeoning growth of this pig, but also the burgeoning growth of my own addiction and the recognition of that addiction.
Well, now that you explain it, Jim, I can understand what you were saying there about the Daisy the pig. I can Now I get it. Okay, thank you. You know, but your life in this story is a really, it's a story of a, it's a hero story. It's the story of a man overcoming a whole lot of problems and going through the whatever one has to go through to come out on the other side scarred, yes, but still whole in a way that really counts. And that is what this story really represents, I think, in a very small way of saying it.
I felt that in many ways, if you look at my earlier work, you'll see that I was kind of circling the same materials. The suicide of my older brother had a profound effect on me, a profound effect on my sister's life as well. And it began to shape, and the destruction, disintegration of my family from an early stage, began to shape how I saw the world and influenced how I wrote about the world as I saw it through my eyes. At a certain point when I was able to get some clean and sober time under my belt and was able to see the world under, through a different pair of glasses, I decided that I better face my past head on or else I was going to continue to write around it. And I didn't want to do that. And so I thought that this book here, I needed to tell as honestly as I possibly could. And I threw out the whole notion of it ever finding a publisher. In fact, I just said, this book is not to be published. This book is to be written. I'm going to write it. And if it finds a publisher, then so be it. If it doesn't, then so be it. I wasn't interested. That wasn't my motivation.
I must say, this is one of those books that you pick up and you end up actually not reading the book, but kind of feeling the book and feeling the inner machinations of a author who has actually lived the life that he is describing in the book. And it has a little bit of all of us in the book. But Jim had a situation in his life that he didn't ask for, but everything was to the max in his life until he managed to get through this tunnel of pain and addiction and all the rest of it. And now he's on a completely different road. He has now become a professor. And, Jim, it's a real winner's story here. And I'm so happy for you. And I'm so happy that you've been able to do that. That's really something.
Actually, now I'm the director of the new MFA program, Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, at California State University at San Bernardino. That's in Southern California. I'd say we're about 60 or 70 miles away from Los Angeles. So that's my new position. We're starting a new program next year, and it's kind of exciting. I'll be able to, this is a logical extension of the many years I've been teaching in an undergraduate creative writing program. So now I'll have the opportunity to really focus in on more dedicated and talented students and hopefully help them write a good book. And then after that, hopefully help them find a publisher for their good books.
Yes. Now, you're working on a new novel now, aren't you?
Well, actually, I finished another memoir. My agent did not like it. And my editor, by the way, didn't like it. Not that she ever read it, but I had to move on. And unfortunately, I just signed made an agreement with Ryan Fisher Harbinger, the Ryan Fisher Harbor Agency, and he's going to be representing the new collection. He was quite excited about it and thought it was a wonderful book, and that's the kind of agent I need. He's looking at the novel. He likes the beginning of the novel. I just recently sent him the rest. So I'll wait to hear back on how he feels about the novel. But between you and I, the personal work that I write, the memoir materials, that's closer to my heart. And that's the book that I'd like to see. If I had my druthers, you know, one book gets published and the other doesn't, I would like to see the new memoir published.
Well, Jim, I'm really happy to hear that you're going to be coming up with new work. And I understand very well the fact that you want to write from your own experience. I think in writing class, that's one of the first things. I took a little course, and I think that was one of the first things that they brought up was, you know, write from your own experience. And I can certainly understand that you have a multitude of stories to tell from your own experience. So I look forward to many more James Brown novels. What I'd like you to do, if you would, is pick something out from your book, L.A. Diaries, and perhaps read a little bit for our listeners.
All right, this piece is from my Papa's Waltz, summer 1962. It takes place in the kitchen of an apartment building where my father and I were sitting, and this was during the time my mother was incarcerated. And I'm writing a very short story about that moment in time, and we'll pick it up at the second paragraph of the story. A few years back, I wrote a novel that uses this memory as its heart. I've mined the territory before, if not this particular moment, then something like it. And I've done it so often that I find myself confusing what actually happened with how I imagine it. In trying to sort between autobiography and fiction or invention, and then trying to put the pieces together so that they make some kind of sense, I've come to think that the truth as it occurs isn't of much use to me, other than, say, as a catalyst for a story. While I'm figuring this out, I lose a couple of years writing a bad novel. I don't get through it, and that's a good thing, because if I hadn't given up, I would have lost more time, and I worry about time. The problem, at least one of them, was that I was being dishonest with myself in the worst, most shameful way. I was writing about people and events and places that I didn't fully understand, and I wasn't good enough at it for it not to show. So I start another book, one that makes me see past what I think actually occurred to what hasn't, but should have, according to that thing I imagine called plot. And the writer's obsession, as I also come to understand, suggests something other than limitation or theme. That as storytellers, we basically spend our lives telling the same story over and over, only we do it from different angles. The trick is disguising it so it doesn't seem the same. The trick is how well we can keep doing it, not once or twice, but hundreds of times, page after page, with one real detail after another. The hardest part is to make it appear seamless and vivid in the end, as if it all came naturally, like magic, like you don't have to think, like it really couldn't have happened any other way.
I love it. I just love it. Thank you so much, James.
You're very welcome, and thanks for, you know, interviewing me. I appreciate it.
That wraps up another edition of Authors Audio. We have been talking to Los Angeles writer James Brown about his book L.A. Diary, an amazing book that walks you through a lifetime of difficulty that James walked through, fighting his way to become a screenwriter and a novelist. And sure enough, James had that strength, that inner strength that enabled him to write this amazing book. So this is Jake D. Steele from Authors Audio. You can always listen to all of our interviews on our website at www.authorsaudio.com. And until next time, this is Jake D. Steele saying, keep dreaming and happy reading. Bye for now.